The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm Tracy Jenkins. I'm the Director of Office Career and Professional Development. Thank you for coming to our Professionalism Series program today. Really honored to introduce our two speakers. Dr. Vinno Papari is the in-house writing instructor for Howley LLP, which is a large firm and has offices across the country as well as internationally. In fact, he's leaving to travel internationally later this week, so we're happy he could join us. And then Tiffany Wood is the recruiting manager at Warwick, Harrington Sutcliffe, in D.C. as well. And Tiffany and Dr. Papari used to work together at Howery, so they're very used to sort of working together, and I think Tiffany has a lot of information that she could share just from an employer's perspective of getting cover letters and getting email correspondence and sort of what works and what doesn't work. So I will share further.
Dr. Papari, thank you. Thanks. I'm going to give you just about a 1 minute summary of what I do at Howery, just to kind of let you know what my position is there. I've been there since August 06. They hired me to develop a writing curriculum for the associates, and I work with a lot of partners as well. Most firms have people outside firms come in and give writing seminars. Howery's one of the few firms that has someone in-house full-time. I'm not an attorney. My PhD is in English, and I was an English professor before this at the Columbia University in the state of New York. And so my job at Howery is basically twofold. I go to all our offices twice a year, and I conduct writing seminars for the associates and the partners, and that's why I'm moving to Europe in 2 days to do that. And I also work one-on-one coaching with associates or partners at any time. So whether it's in person or over the phone, it doesn't matter. Because as you know, as you will know, that attorneys at a firm like Howery are writers more than anything else. As a matter of fact, one of the associates in our Chicago office said when people ask him what he does, he says he's a writer. He doesn't say he's an attorney. He turns in his computer, he writes for 10 hours or however long he does, and then he goes home. So I'm going to talk for a few minutes about concise communications. This has to do, obviously, with cover letters and emails, but it applies to any type of writing that you do, even for your class, it doesn't matter. These are very general tips I'm going to give you. Feel free to ask questions at any time. And then Tiffany's going to maybe interject while I'm talking, and she's going to talk, give her presentation, I may interject, and then we'll leave time for questions at the end. So we want to first get an idea of what year they are?
Sure.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So how many first years are there here? Okay, second, third, okay, all right, one, okay, no problem, it doesn't really matter, I mean, it's good writing, it's good writing, I don't care how old you are, over a year, it doesn't matter, so I'm going to talk about concise communication, and, you know, this is important because all of us write too much, regardless of what type of writing we're doing, I think, or what level we are, we all write too much, and I'm going to talk about ways to make your writing concise and powerful so that people read what you write, want to read it, because it's not just kind of the usual cliched, overwritten kind of stuff. Okay. So, I'm going to, Can we do that? Great, okay.
What?
No, that's perfect. Brevity is best, okay? When you write, all right, you want to be Clint Eastwood, not Ben Stiller. Okay, this is what I mean by that. Think about, who are some of the most iconic film stars in American film from the past 30 years? Someone throw some people out here. Some names out. No one watching movies anymore?
Al Pacino.
Al Pacino, good. Who else?
Charlton Heston.
Heston, yeah, sure. Arnold Schwarzenegger, okay. Tom Cruise. So I talk about this with our associates, and I say Tom Cruise. One of them said Tom Cruise, and I said, but the Top Gun Tom Cruise, not the Jerry Maguire Tom, or probably anything he's done in the past 10 years, Tom Cruise. Top Gun Tom Cruise, okay. Brevity is best, okay? Clint Eastwood did not say, I would appreciate it if you would make my day better. He said,
make my day.
Okay, Arnold Schwarzenegger did not say, well, I'm going to leave for a little while, and I'm going to come back later on. He said, I'll be back, okay? And, you know, so be a Clint Eastwood, not a Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller, okay, he's forever typecast now in all of his roles. How is he characterized? What is his character? He's a typical character now. Kind of a bumbling, stumbling kind of, you know, not someone who really exudes power. Okay, the people who are concise exude power, control, and confidence. And that's what you've got to be thinking about. You say things once, you say them well, and you move on. Now, that doesn't mean that in cover letters, if you have a lot of experience, you leave it out. It's just that you talk about it, you mention it once, and then you move on. Okay, think about when people are lying, or when they're saying something they don't really believe in. What do? Do they lie once, then they move on? What do? They keep on digging themselves deeper and deeper into that hole. They repeat themselves. Okay, so repetition is annoying in anything that you do. The more you talk, the less assured you appear. Okay. When you write, the subject, verb, object, do we have any English majors or people who are, you know, grammar, people who like grammar, or, I don't know, look at the noses, you know, scrunch. Okay, well, I guess I'm the only person here that enjoys that kind of stuff, but that's okay. Subject, verb, object. Sentence structure is the most logical and it's the easiest to understand. So write your sentences like that. It is very logical. We have a subject. We see the subject. We want to know what the subject is doing, and then we want to know if the subject is doing it too. That's it. Okay. Now, my next slide talks about how to be subtly persuasive. I'm not saying you're a great person. Without saying I am enormously qualified. Okay. What we talk about a lot in writing is show, don't tell. Don't show someone that you're great. Don't just tell them you're great. And you do that by spending a lot more time on your verb, a lot more time on your verbs than you probably are. One of the weakest verbs in the English language is the verb to be. Okay? Am, is, are, was, were. Define that for me, somebody. What is the? How would you define the verb to be? Any philosophy majors here? This is a state of existence, right? Now, without, you know, getting into a philosophical debate, it doesn't really mean much. Okay? So this is actually an easy edit to make in any of your writings, is anytime you have a to-be verb, you want to replace it with something more powerful. Okay, we have a dog, his name is Cole. Okay, he's a Labrador retriever, it's a black lab. Does anyone have a black lab here, or a lab retriever, a golden retriever, any of those? Does anyone do any? No movies, no dogs, don't watch TV, I mean, okay. I know you're busy, but it's important to strike a balance in your life. Maybe that's another seminar. All right? Cole is an energetic Labrador retriever. Well, that's great, but how would you say is energetic? Am I telling you that's good or bad? Because you're all eating. That's why no one can talk. I realize this. Your faces are all stuffed. Okay. Energetic is neutral, isn't it? It's not really saying good or bad. It can be energetic, can be good or bad. Okay, so I want to replace that with he radiates energy. Radiates. Okay? Unless we're talking about nuclear radiation, radiates is very positive, isn't it? Okay, he radiates energy, that sunshine kind of thing. That means I like the fact that he's hyper. Okay? You know, the flip side to that could be he's neurotic. But radiates is very powerful. And I'm not telling you he's a great dog. I don't say Cole is a great dog. He is an energetic Labrador retriever. I just say this, and you know that. Okay, and that makes your writing concise as well. You shave the sentence off. Okay. Also, papers were on the floor. You know, this is especially important in legal writing with statements of fact, where you need to be subtly persuasive in your statements of fact. Okay, the papers were on the floor. It's not really saying much. The papers filled the floor is better, but littered. Negative verb tells me that you don't like it as a writer. Okay. Same thing here. You can be more concise. Some people say they hate adjectives and adverbs. You know, some readers do. I don't buy that, but I think that too many can make your writing too long. So I replace clumsy, walked, and slowly with lumber. All right? It's a much more vivid verb anyway. Okay. Now, just like with verbs, we also have nouns. Okay. When you think about categorizing yourself in your cover letters or anything, how you term something or somebody is a filter to how you are viewed or how your subject is viewed, okay? Is someone a public servant or a politician? Okay, which has the more negative viewpoint attached to it? Politician, sure, okay? You know, it's funny. John McCain is a Straight Talk Express, okay? And some people are saying, you know, wait a minute. Straight Talk isn't always good. You know, the Straight Talk is a very positive thing, right? He tells it the way it is. Okay, what's the flip side to being a Straight Talker? You're abrasive, you're blunt, you have no decorum. Okay? Any of these things, is someone an independent thinker or an egocentric loner? Okay. Flip-flop. Alright, flip-flopping is, you know, especially, with flip-flop is a term you hear all the time and with politics. But, you know, if you think about it, it's become pejorative, hasn't it? Flip-flopping is bad. But, you know, flip-flopping can also be, look at the bright side, the positive side. It's people who change their mind after thoughtful analysis. It can be, but it doesn't matter. Flip-flopping is seen as so pejorative. Okay. Dried plum or prune title of this slide, by the way. I was wondering when this is going to happen. Now, who eats prunes? What's not asking for hands, okay? Oh, you can. One person raised their hand and I said that. But typically, what age group eats prunes?
Older.
Older! Well, not old, older, okay? Now, you know, prunes are just dried plums. That's all they are. Okay, so about 6 months ago, the geniuses who manufactured prunes said, you know, we could open this market up to the rest of the other 80% of the population that we're missing by calling them dried plums. And that's what they're calling them now. And sales have gone through the roof. Just because of that. Okay. All right, when you write, you should be able to name a clear actor and a clear verb in any of your sentences. You'll underline it. And you should be able to, it should be something tangible that you can picture in any of your sentences. Okay. The protesters marched on the Pentagon to protest the war while the military demanded more forces. We have protesters marching and we have military demanding. I can picture all of those things. Okay. But if you make that into a very passive construction, marches were occurring, you can't picture the verb occurring. Occurring is, you know, it's too abstract. Okay. And demands were being made. It's hard to picture that. Okay. You know, because I am a writing geek, dork, whatever you want to call me, I'm sure there's a flip side to that, not a, you know, a very positive way of saying that. I live for things in print that I can use for my seminars and I talk to our attorneys. This is a recent quote that was given when the sheriff was hunting for some fugitive. And he said, it is believed that he has reached a location where his need to move in high speed or long distance no longer exists. Wow. Is that a bunch of BS? I mean, what could you say in four words instead of that? He is in hiding. Right? Same thing. Okay? But when you read this, you think, oh, come on, you can't be serious. Okay? Again, here's another thing to think about when you write. Okay, keep your subjects and your verbs together. Keep them as close together as possible. Alright, now I'm going to may tax your brains here by asking a grammar question, but look at this second one, okay? Where's my subject? I heard it already. Where was it? I think I heard it. Maybe I just imagined it. Maybe I didn't hear it. Yes, who said it? Distribution is the subject. Where's my verb?
It is.
See how much distance we have there? Okay? There's a reason behind this, and that is why this is bad. And this is actually, I can show you much worse than this. As a writer, as a reader, as I talked about earlier, we grab onto the subject. We want to know what the subject is doing. If we have to wait till the end of the sentence to find out, if there's too much distance, our short-term memory dumps that subject. We have to go back and reread to find out what it is. So keep them as close together as possible. Okay, another easy edit. Meaningless words. Have any of these words, the words really, very, what does basically mean? What does essentially mean? You can't define those. Those are what we call ineffective intensifiers. Get them out of here. Get them out of there. Great quote by Mark Twain. Okay, applies to really any of these. Okay. it's very true. In fact, Mark Twain is some of those great gems. Okay, when you edit, when you make things concise, what's called working words and glue words. Okay, working words are the meat of a sentence. Glue words are the prepositions, the noun markers, things like that. Your goal in any of your sentences is to have more working words than glue words. If you have more glue words than working words, then you have a fat sentence and you've got to revise it. Okay? Okay. For example. Okay. Trial by jury was requested by the defendant. How many working words are in that sentence? Where's the meat? Four, right? We have trial, jury, requested, defendant. So we have four working words, five blue words. We got to revise that. How can you revise that?
Defendant requested a trial by jury.
Even better.
Jury trial.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Same thing with these. I'm not going to spend time on these, but it's the same thing, okay? These are real sentences. In many instances, so far as the jurors are concerned, the jury instructions are not understandable because they are too poorly written. Okay. No one's going to read that. People are going to read that, and they're just going to get frustrated. Okay, another thing. This is small, so I apologize. I don't know if you can see it from the back. But this is a list. Can you see? Yeah, I think it's pretty good. Okay. Obvious inferences and redundant modifiers. All of these phrases are really, they're redundant because those two words, one of those words is in a smaller class, and they mean the same thing. For example, aren't all gifts free? Okay, how many times do we see free gift and added bonus? Every bonus is added. That's the definition of a bonus. Okay. The very best. You can only have one best. Now, I said to this, and one associate said, nope. I've got to say very, because when I say very, you know it's really, really the best. Fine. Gather together. You just gather. Okay, all outcomes are final. Okay. Merge together. Forward. All of these. Let's see. Some of the ones that we see a lot could potentially. How about just potentially? Okay. Potential is a condition. It's this conditional anyway. Or could possibly. Same thing. Excess waste. Past accomplishment. Unexpected surprise. Completely full. Currently pending. Some of these, you know, here's the thing. In the legal industry, there are a lot of phrases that are redundant, but they've become almost terms of art and they're used. You know, the phrase enter into a contract itself is redundant. You don't enter into, of course you enter into something. You don't exit into anything. You don't enter out of anything. You just enter something. Okay. You know, any of these, I have another slide actually. I love these. No, I guess it's only it. Okay. You know, could or could not. That's not on here, but could or could not. Might or might not. May or may not. Okay, could or could not, you just say could. Right? May or may not, you just say may. Might or might not, you just say might. Okay, you know, we're redundant in a lot of things we say. Tiff and I were talking about this earlier. PIN number. Personal identification number. Okay? I say ATM machine all the time, but what I'm saying is automatic teller machine. Okay? And, you know, HIV virus is the other one that people say a lot. Okay? So, some of these things, despite the fact that only 50 people attended, okay, how would you shorten that?
Only 15 people.
Well, not only that, well, not only, not quite. Even though only 15 people attended. Okay, in the event that no one shows up.
If
no one shows up, okay? In a situation where a class is closed.
If.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. When? Sorry, when? Okay. He was aware of the fact that she was in the room. Okay. He knew. At that point in time, he closed the door. You could really just make the argument for he closed the door. Or you could say he then closed the door. Okay. But in the interest of time, I'm going to spend about 10 seconds on this slide. But what I want you to be careful of here is the use of negatives in sentences, okay? When people use negatives, the reader almost always has to switch that to a positive to make sense of it. And people get into trouble when they include two negatives in a sentence because you have to start thinking about your math, okay? A negative times a negative is a positive, all right? And, you know, in couple letters, this is especially important because you don't really want any negatives because you're talking about how good you are, all right? So, for example, there was never no one who does not want to be there. How many negatives are there?
Three,
right? There was never no one who did not want to be there. Three. So the outcome is going to, the revision would be negative. Who could revise that? There's always someone who does not want to be there. Okay, now, certain industries are famous for their use of negatives because they don't want people to understand what they're saying. Insurance companies do that a lot. Okay, sentences like this, which are real, people look at it and they say, you know, I don't even know, I'll just sign. Okay. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal today, actually, about patient consent forms with doctors. They're beginning to rewrite them. They're realizing that consent forms, people aren't reading them. They're just signing them because they don't want to read all that stuff, and they can't even understand this. There's a movement right now to move a lot of those documents to plain English. Okay. There's one thing you could do to make your writing flow, use that ubiquitous term flow, is the use of transitions. Okay. What does a transition do? Someone tell me, what does a transition word actually do?
Emphasize.
You can't say it transitions. Yeah.
Emphasize.
Well, it does emphasize, but what is it? Think about it, a larger picture.
It signals the reader?
Yeah, signals. What does it signal, though?
That you're moving on to another point.
Right. It's a bridge between what you talked about and what you're going to talk about. Okay, when I see the word, nevertheless, I know that what I read is going to be an opposite of what I just read. Okay, when I see the word, therefore, I know that I'm going to read about a conclusion or a consequence. That one word is that bridge. Okay. And, you know, don't furiously copy these down because you can find them on the internet. You can also find them in any $15 grammar guide. You can buy them, I'm sure, in an AU bookstore. Okay? I mean, they're the same thing here. Okay. When I see the word, however, I know that I'm going to read something that's in opposition to what I just read. Okay? Now, when you write your cover letters, think about major transitions. Those are sentences. Okay? Topic sentences. I know you've heard about topic sentences since first grade, second grade, or whatever, but, I mean, I still talk to attorneys and partners about the importance of topic sentences and, yes, thesis statements. Those things are still relevant in legal documents. Every sentence you write should have a topic sentence that forecasts what you're going to talk about. And, you know, I was looking over some cover letters lately, and people would start sentences, they would start paragraphs with a sentence that had nothing to do with the rest of the paragraph. Nothing to do. Okay. What the topic sentence does is that it closes what you just read about, and it introduces a new topic. For example, pedestrian writing skills are not the only attribute that would make me a successful attorney. Okay, that's a topic sentence. It's a topic sentence that's telling me what did I just talk about with that topic sentence? Writing skills. Okay, but I'm moving on to another one. Same thing here. Okay. I talked in the previous paragraph about argumentative writing, and now I'm going to move on to oral persuasion. Okay.
Quick question.
Yes.
Almost started with but besides, except the third one.
Wait, say that again?
You're starting the paragraph with but and besides.
Yes.
I was under the understanding that paragraphs were not supposed to be started with but or besides or because or...
You're going to get me started on this. I'll have to follow through. Starting a sentence with but and because besides is absolutely 100% grammatically correct. Okay? Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Okay? They're wrong. Now, they're wrong because when they tell you not to begin a sentence with and or but, what they're thinking of is a sentence like this. Okay? I went to the store, period, but, actually that's even grammatically correct too, okay? What they're thinking of is a sentence fragment. That's not a good example. I'm trying to think of a quick one. But when they talk about not beginning a sentence with and or but, or because, here's a good one. I went to the store, I'll use because. Because I was hungry. Okay? That is a sentence fragment. Okay? It's not a complete sentence. Alright? But if it's rephrased, if it's rewritten, I went to the store, period. Because I was hungry, comma, I bought everything on the shelves. That's a complete sentence. Okay? So, you know, it's absolutely grammatically correct. It's a shame to hear that. It distresses me. It's, you know, that's a very old school kind of, you know, people, you know, I've always heard sometimes, I've told never to do that. It's acceptable. You can do it. Okay? As long as it's a complete sentence. Now, those fragments are used all the time in fiction, in creative nonfiction. They're used all the time. But I'm sure I can insert joke about legal brief here, but, you know, legal briefs are nonfiction. Okay? So you wouldn't, it's not acceptable. Okay. And cover letters, that's right. Cover letters are not in fiction either. Okay. Let me see here. I'm trying to think. Okay. I'm gonna skip ahead to some ideas for revising. Okay. When you write, does anyone read what they write out loud? Okay. Probably the single best tip that anyone can give you is to read everything you write out loud. Okay. Just tell people you're doing it. They don't think you're talking to yourself. But you're going to catch things you'll never catch by reading out loud. Here's why. You've spent so much time on what you're writing, you're too close to it. You need distance, okay? That's why the worst time to edit something is when? Right afterwards, okay? You know, ideally, you'd want to walk around the block, sleep on it, take an hour. The worst thing to do is to do this as soon as, is to edit as soon as you finish writing. You're too close to it. Okay? So you need that distance. Anything you can do to give yourself distance from your writing. Reading out loud does that. Reading out loud, you're going to catch sentence fragments. You're going to catch run-on sentences. You're going to catch long sentences. You're going to catch poor rhythm. You're going to catch the fact that you started 5 sentences in a row with the same word. You're going to catch all those things. Okay? When we read, we do what's called sub-vocalizing. Sub-vocalizing is that voice in your head as you read silently. I hope it's that voice in your head, but it's that voice in your head when you read silently. Okay? So, good writing sounds good. Read everything you write out loud. You'll catch things you'll never catch otherwise. And print it out and read it. Don't read on your screen. Again, you need that distance. Even better than reading out loud is read backwards. Now, I don't mean go to the end of your document and read every sentence backwards. What I mean is go to the end of your document and just go from end to beginning, obviously reading every sentence forward. Here's why. When you read beginning to end, no matter how much you try to focus, if you say, I'm only going to focus on issues of punctuation and grammar, when you go beginning to end, on some level, you're always focusing on organization. You can't help it. You're always going to do that. If you start at the end and read to the beginning, you can't focus on organization. You can only focus on punctuation and grammar. Okay? And make that revision for punctuation and grammar last. I'm assuming you revise several times, but there's nothing more frustrating than if you do that first read for grammar and punctuation, there's nothing more frustrating than doing that first read and revising sentences that never make it your final version anyway, because you know, that's totally inefficient. Okay.
I was just going to highlight, I think this is probably about the third time I've heard and give a similar presentation, and the printing things out and reading them not off the computer screen, I think I was a little skeptical at first, but once I started doing this, you'd be surprised at how much you catch. And I'm 100% convinced that even in this document that was passed out, a lot of these things in, you know, an email, I'm interested in relocating to Washington, D.C. following my graduate from Duke. I mean, if this person had taken the time to print out the email and read that, you would have caught it right away. So that's really one of the most helpful tips I've gotten in a long time.
Yeah, and you know that. I mean, that I'm going to skip to. This is why spell check. Talk about is when I was teaching at Colgate, which is a fine institution. I got papers that mentioned that I had a paper on attention deficit disorder. Okay. Now. Okay. I don't know what to say. But when you get orthoeficate spelled wonderfully, it's correct. Okay? But, you know, this is where spell check was of no use, or the dreaded serial killer. Okay? You know, this is just bad proofreading. It's relying on spell check. By the way, don't rely on grammar check. It's way too iffy. Okay? But, you know, when I see this, I'm done as a reader. I mean, you've lost me. Because I can't think of anything else. Which is true. It's really true. Okay. Okay. Should we, do you want to maybe both talk about these things?
Absolutely.
Okay. We're going to talk specifically about cover letters and about email correspondence too. Okay. Tiffany obviously sees these on a daily basis. The first one, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. Don't repeat your resume. That's your cover letter. You want to elaborate on things that aren't in your resume or the things that you maybe didn't have time to cover in your resume. Okay, you don't just repeat it. All right. You know, when I was at Colgate, I also directed the Writing Center there, and I had to hire student consultants to work in the Writing Center. And each year we had about 90 applications for about 5 positions. Okay, that's a lot of applications for not many positions. I needed a reason to put people, to disqualify people immediately, to put them in a pile and say, I'm done with you. Okay? And any employer looks for reasons to disqualify you in a competitive market. It makes their job easier.
I hate to say that, but I mean, it's a good point just in terms of making that first impression and really, I mean, similar numbers. We probably have, you know, 600, 700 applications for 10 to 12 spots in our summer associate program. So things that, it just doesn't matter, because you want to do whatever you can to make it into the smaller pile, and simple mistakes and poorly written, or just frankly boring cover letters that don't tell me a thing will probably be one of those things that you can fix that.
Yeah, it's funny, because I used to think that it was assumed that everyone would submit a perfectly proofread cover letter, job application, resume, anything, and that's kind of the bare minimum. If you do that, you at least survive. But I've come to believe that if you submit something that's perfect, it actually puts you way ahead of everyone else. That's the reality. I mean, that's sad, but that's the reality of it, is that things that are perfectly proofread, unfortunately, I think we almost expect that we're going to see things like that aren't perfect. But if it's perfect, that puts you at a whole different level. And that, you know, if you want to... Tiffany has a lot of examples in the third one. But my goal, and this applies to legal writing as well, okay? Your goal should be to write something so unique that no one else could have written it, okay? That no one else could have written it. Only your name could go on this, okay? So talking about the fact you have leadership roles, and many people could say that, okay? You need to write something, you know, that says, oh, only Joe Smith could have written this, okay? Because it's so unique, all right?
Yeah.
Segway.
I was going to say, this is, you know, I think one of the points that I always like to cover, and I really try to stress to a lot of my friends who are in law school and applying for jobs, not just with firms, but any job, is to really make your cover letter stand out and be you. And I just had a situation where, going through one of our letters, that these are all from one school, and this is just kind of a visual aid. Using a form cover letter, like either you got from the internet or Career Services sent it out as an example, is like kiss of death. These are all cover letters. The highlighted portions are the same between each one. They're all from different people, and they say the exact same thing. The exact same phrasing, the exact same sentence structure, the same format, and everything. And it's just kind of like reading through these, I was like, oh my God. They literally copied a cover letter, and I just, you know, it's just one of those things that just leaves. It honestly made us, I can't say that I make all the decisions in my firm, one, you know, 100% of the time, but really, I mean, why would you take a second look, you know, if you were in a position to be like, wow, gosh, these students couldn't even come up with, you know, a cover letter that was their own without copying something that we've already sent out to them. So I think that's probably,
yeah,
I mean, this is an extreme situation, and, you know, I won't tell you the name of the school, but you guys are in our school there. No,
it's not.
Candidate for your firm, and it's generic enough that maybe you wouldn't notice it, but then when you're reading the exact same one over and over again, I'm like, oh my God, they all have the same sentence. So
what they said, what they should be changed to, you know, what they've done is they've written a couple letters in such a manner that everyone can read them.
Everyone in the world.
I read those, literally the exact same words. I'm not talking about the exact same, you know, the kind of the meaning. literally word for word the same words, okay, all from the same school, okay? Now, to paraphrase John F. Kennedy, it's not what the firm can do for you, it's what you can do for the firm, okay? You know, in any kind of job, employers generally don't care how their job is going to make you a better person, okay? But let's be honest, this is the business world, this is the corporate world, it's about how what you can do to make them better. It's great that it's going to expand your horizons and make you a better leader, make you a better writer, but, you know, that's great, but it's about how you can help them. So think about, that kind of should be your theme for the cover letter, is how you can help them.
And I think there's a particularly good example of that in here. And even just the poor phrasing of, you know, one is a concept you really shouldn't be mentioning, and two, the opportunity to work at your firm firsthand would allow me the opportunity to work directly with seasoned legal professionals in various fields, allowing me to profit from their expertise. And, I mean, that's just kind of like, okay. Oh, yeah, sure we do. And that's just another example of careful word choice. You know, the word profit, I mean, there's probably, even if you were going to have that sentence in there, there's probably a better word, you know, you could have chosen other than profit. But clearly, you know, when you think of profit, you think of monetarily. Like, I'm monetarily profiting from your lawyer's experience and expertise. So that's just, you know, just another way that the focus of the letter and what you say in it should really be about how you could benefit the organization, not vice versa.
And look at that sentence, for example. This is a good example sentence, okay? This sentence needs to be trimmed in fat, what I call trimmed in fat considerably, okay? Where's the verbosity in this sentence, okay? Look at that sentence Tiffany just read, some of the improper phrasing, besides the fact that, you know, we want to say profit. Where's just the clutter in there? Where's the redundancy, by the way? There's a couple examples.
Opportunity to work.
Okay. How about working with your firm firsthand? You don't need firsthand in there. Okay. The opportunity, instead of saying the opportunity to work with your firm firsthand would allow me, what would you say instead of that? Yeah, working at your firm. I mean, I would provide that further. Of course, but just off the top of my head, working with your firm would allow me the opportunity to work, or working with, I mean, you have to revise this considerably. You would say, in this position, I would work directly with seasoned legal professionals. Can you just say attorneys, maybe, or legal, I mean, seasoned, you know, in various fields, allowing me to profit from their expertise. I mean, there's so much there. That's, you know, that's probably 30 words, close to 30 words, you could probably say in about 8. Okay, there's so much there. Alright, and that's just complete waste. You know, look at the second bullet point. The second bullet point, under simple errors that proofreading could have prevented. Okay. Whether for students or customers, during my days in retail, notice the spelling mistake, at Books a Million, my motivation has been to provide resolutions to problems that satisfy the needs of the client and demands of proficiency of my employer. Great business ease. Junk. Okay. What could you say? I mean, what, first of all, what is that person? Can you envision anything? Can you envision the person who wrote this? Can you envision them doing this? No, because they're not doing anything. It's so vague and so abstract. How could you shorten that sentence? Let me give you a hint. You could chunk this. Okay, so take the phrase, my motivation has been to provide resolutions to problems. How could you probably whittle that to 3 words? I resolve problems. What'd you say?
Problem solver.
Yeah, I'm a problem solver. I mean, something along those lines, okay? I solve problems that satisfy the needs of the clients. Okay, I would assume that they satisfy the needs of the client because they can solve. So they don't even need that. Okay, satisfy the needs of the client and the demands for efficiency of my employer. This is a really good example, unfortunately, of what we see a lot, not just what you see in the corporate world, that kind of where more is better kind of thing, okay? I solve problems. Now, even then, I solve problems. That's so abstract. I solve problems. I mean, what? First of all, I mean, what, you need to be more specific. Again, a million people solve problems in their work at Books a Million. Be specific. What did you do?
I sold 50 books in 1 second.
I sold 50 books in how long? 1 second. Okay, a little fast. But let's say, you know, or I was, what this person probably means is that when someone came to the front desk and said, where's the Harry Potter section, they helped them. Okay? I'm not saying for that, but I think you need to be specific, okay? I often help people... Go ahead.
Provide quality customer service.
Yeah, but even then, I mean, isn't that so... I could say that about any job. I could say that about fast food. I could say that about clothing. You have to be specific there, because people are going to, again, that's a cover letter, that's a name I can put on anyone's retail experience. I helped people, you know, so hard to find books or special order. I would call around, when people wanted a book, I wouldn't just say, oh, it's on that section. I would walk into that section and pull the book out for them. Or I would go to the computer and help them locate it at another store. That's specific. And I can visualize that. I can't visualize my motivation has been to provide resolutions to problems and satisfy the needs. You know, notice also when I read this how clunky this sounds. It's about as unrhythmic as possible. My motivation has been to provide resolutions to problems and satisfy the needs of the client that demands. You know, there's so many words, those buzzwords like efficiency, resolution, client, motivation. You know, whew. Okay.
Moving on, one of the other important points from this slide are just about business emailing and email cover letters and really kind of your first impression with a potential employer, especially if you're sending emails or sending email thank you notes or sending emails to check on the status of your application. I think it's not in this slide, but it's another one talking about writing up sort of, here we go, write upwards. I always, not really surprised anymore because I've been doing this for a while, but sometimes I'll still get emails that are really, they're just written in a way that you would, you know, send your resume to your friend, and it's kind of like, hey, I'm interested and wanted to know if you guys are still looking for summer associates for next summer. You know, I'm interested, here's my letter, you know, here's my cover letter, resume, let me know if anything else is needed. And it's just kind of written in such a casual, informal manner that it's kind of off-putting in the sense that, you know, you didn't sort of take the time to address it and use this first email introduction as a chance to really, highlight and set yourself apart. And I think I have just an example of a really short email. But as long as we're on the subject of emails, I think I have this in here too. If you're going to send your resume to a potential employer from an email address other than your school address, I always recommend using your school address, but if for some reason you want to send them all through Gmail or anything like that, just have a very simple email address. Believe me, it's like just becomes a laughing stock at the firm when I get a resume from Sugar Woman for You, or there's all these examples I can think of that are just, you just look at it and you're like, oh no, come on. And there, you know, and clearly there could be other, I think I had one that was something about like, it was like Red Devil, and I knew that it must have been like a school mascot or something, but just immediately you're thinking, oh man, this is probably their email address for something like that. Totally different.
Yeah, no alcohol names in your email addresses. I mean, you know, when we hired someone, I'm the professional development department at Howard, so we're in charge of training attorneys. We hired an entry-level position for a recent college graduate about a year ago, you know, and we got emails, you know, and the emails were, you know, strawberry daiquiri something, or, you know, I mean, Jaeger. I mean, I kind of, like, lost track how many Jaeger and, you know, various mixed drinks, but, you know, that does make you stand out. Not for good reasons.
And the other thing about that is to put your name in the subject line of the email, and that, you're kind of thinking, why would I put my name? It's my name right next to it in the prom line, but it just really, it's just a helpful tip because, you know, I'd say on December 2nd it was, after December 1st, when I was allowed to apply for decision, I had an entire email box full of things that said summer associate, interested in summer programs, summer associate. So it's just one more little thing that you can do. Put your, just, you know, Tom B. Jones - interested in summer associate position. And I think I have another note in here about making sure your name is on everything that you submit, because honestly, there's a lot of stuff that gets printed out. I can't speak for all firms or all potential employers, but I know, particularly at my firm, I print everything out that I receive. So, you know, it's something I switched around at the center, and I've got 4 pages of a writing sample that are numbered, but they don't have a name on it. Like, you know, digging around, being like, which, like, you know, memory, trying to figure out which pages match which writing sample.
Do you have a question? I'm a Chinese, and my name is very difficult for foreigners to pronounce. If I write my Chinese on it, I wonder if they can pronounce it and find me easily. So can I use an English name that sounds like my Chinese name?
I guess that's a good question. I think that, certainly on your resume, what I see a lot is when people, if their name is particularly hard to pronounce, they'll put like an English name that they go by or that sounds similar in parentheses. So, you know, it would be like, you know, Tiffany, and then in parentheses, the name that I go by, and then last name. And I think that really helps because that way there's no confusion. If you're looking, you know, say before an interview, if an attorney gets your resume and there's no confusion about what you should be called, if you introduce yourself as Pam, but on your resume it says something completely different, I guarantee the first thought that goes through their head is like, oh my God, I printed out the wrong resume for the student I'm interviewing. But if that name, you know, is there, then that's helpful. That helps. But
this is an important one, I think. Sending emails when you know they'll be read. This is a little trick. I mean, if you're sending emails to prospective employers at 2 a.m., and that's fine. You might be a night owl, and, you know, that's fine. But a couple of things. Keep in mind that when you say tomorrow, because you haven't been asleep, you know, when they wake up, your tomorrow is their today. More importantly, if you send an email to people at 2 a.m. or 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock when they're not checking them, when they get to work in the morning, they've got maybe 30 emails. They've got a long list. Okay, when I get up in the morning, I love to just take that control, you know, and just highlight those that I'm just going to delete immediately without reading them. Okay? So here's a little tip. Send emails when you know they'll be read. Because if you send them their business hours, people have that, whatever that function is on Outlook, where on the bottom right-hand corner, a summary of the message shows up, they're going to see it immediately. So send it when it's going to be read, when it's going to be looked at. Okay, don't send it at 2 in the morning because it may get deleted. That's really important. I mean, I do that, you know, we have offices in Europe, and so there's a 6-hour time difference. And so if I have to send things then at like 5:30 in the morning, because I know they're going to be read. If I send them at 3 o'clock our time, it's 9 o'clock there, they may not read them. And if I need a response quickly, I've got to be on their time. So send them when you know that literally it's going to catch their attention.
And then I think one other important point about emails is even if you're attaching a resume, a cover letter, a writing sample, and a transcript to the email, don't just send the body of email completely blank. That's just a personal pet peeve of mine, kind of like, just tell me what's attached. Or even if you are repeating a little section of your cover letter in the cover email, then that's fine. But just getting a blank email with nothing in the body and just a bunch of attachments and a subject, it's just annoying. I'm sure anybody would feel the same way. And then I guess now would be a good time to transition into a question that I get all the time. Believe me, my sister just graduated from law school, I guess, 2 years ago. A bunch of my friends are just starting to make the transition from law student to lawyer, and everybody's always like, do I email or send a regular mail? Do I email or send a regular mail? And I believe me, I'm not claiming to be an expert sort of on how all firms would like it or how all potential employers, but I have worked for 3 major firms now, and I can tell you it really doesn't make a difference. So whatever you want to do, either send it regular mail or send it by email. Don't do both because it's going to be that person who sent 2 or 3, 4 copies of your resume. And I'd say that more important than the decision to regularly mail or email is timing. And that is something, I don't know if you guys are having questions about, but I get the question of timing, like when should I send my application in all the time? And I think that, just to break it down, the early bird doesn't always get the worm. I got a resume. Somebody came in and hand-delivered their resume for the summer 2008 on the first day of my 2007 summer associate program. So there I am, like, rushing around all morning, like, trying to get everything ready for my summer associates to start, and I have somebody show up at our office wanting to hand-deliver their resume for next year's class. And just right after that, I was just like, I wanted to rip it right in half because I was just so stressed out. So I honestly think that in the way of timing, it's great if you want to go ahead and get a jump start, maybe use some of your downtime over the summer to start preparing things, but don't send applications for the following summer until the recruiting season really begins, which is usually around August, because you certainly don't want to be the ones that was, you know, one of the people that was received in July that just gets put to the side of the desk and sort of that, I'll think about that when it comes time to start fall recruiting phase. Does that make sense? Does anybody have a question for my clients, or?
Yeah, I think also this, what I've been noticing the past 10 minutes we've been talking about is, you know, kind of the clash of generations. I mean, I forgot, is it the people in there from like 20 to 30, what is it, millennium? I don't know. What generation is, like, I don't even know anymore. What's the generation called that people are like 20 to, they're after X, there was what, Y?
Generation Y.
And then what was after Y?
Millennial.
Okay. So I mean, so much. It's funny because so much has been made of in the corporate world. There's a lot of seminars on working with the millennial generation. You know, how to work with all these young whippersnappers who grew up with cable television and IM and texting and email and all that stuff. But really, nothing. You know, someone's got to do. There's a niche here for a seminar for people your age. You know, or your generation, for the most part, if you're 20 to 30 or whatever, on working with people who are 60 and over, 50 and over. I mean, I probably shouldn't have said that, because one of you guys is going to take my idea, but there's a lot of money to be made there, because I think you need to understand, for example, there are partners at our firm who have their secretaries print out every email. They don't have a computer, or they don't use email. Their secretary prints up every email, and they read them. I know. Look at the looks on your faces. You're incredulous. I mean, how? You can't imagine that. But there are people that do. And so you've got to think about the fact that, you know, the reality is that you're, you know, when we talk about things like formal correspondence should be treated as a business letter, think about your audience. I mean, think about the fact that, you know, most people didn't grow up, you know, using, you know, the letter U, the letter R. You know, to mean you are, or you're, or the number four to mean F-O-R, or anything like that.
I
mean,
abbreviating definitely. I mean, a lot of people like, I'm deaf interested, or...
Yeah, I mean, can you believe that? And, you know, when I was in academia, you know, and I'd get emails from students that were as if they were sending me a text message. And I'd respond, they'd get the message, because I'd respond to their emails in an overly formal tone, as if to say, you know, you need to understand your audience. I'm not saying don't use that language. I'm saying just understand who you're writing for. I mean, you're writing for people, you know, who didn't grow up with that or just don't like it. I mean, you just detest technology. I mean, this idea of a laptop is, you know, the idea of a laptop is this. You know? So that's, you know, something to do with your audience. That's important. I mean, in any of that, you know, or formal correspondence, and that's important. What else?
You want to
Well, there's some good sentences in here to go over to kind of gauge how well you revise these, but if you have questions, yeah.
When you're emailing, like, an application, I know that you said just, like, take out a part of your cover letter. Is it bad to just copy and paste your cover letter into the email?
No, that's just fine. I think that... I don't really think there's a difference between, like, if your email is serving as your cover letter, that's fine. The things I would caution against are a lot of times adding in the text. Well, you have to be very careful about that, especially nowadays when people are using BlackBerries, because it's great. It always looks really professional if somebody spaced out, you know, I'll get an example. They've made their cover email sort of look exactly like a cover letter would with, you know, sort of a signature block at the top, like this. I don't know if you guys can all see it. There's, you know, kind of like a signature block. But if you open this on your BlackBerry, or if you open it and, you know, and it's in HTML, I guess, versus versus sort of the normal look. I would honestly, if you're going to send something before formatting it, send it to a test email first. Like, send it from your school to your Gmail and just see how it looks. Because, like I said, that just gets, you know, then your address is all messed up. And I think we were spending our time about this just beforehand, about there's some kind of a font that, I don't know whether you get emails and the apostrophe or change to question marks. Like
percent sign.
Yeah, and it's so weird and just so distracting to a reader to be trying to read through a cover letter that has that, because you're thinking, is this an error or is this just, you know, formatting? And so that's the only thing that I would caution against. If you're attaching things, especially if you attach them as a PDF, you know that the formatting is going to come across just as you want it, just as you sent it.
Actually, I would rephrase that. I would say, convert everything to PDF. I mean, there are free programs out there that just do that. I mean, don't send this as a Word document.
Yeah.
I mean, it's too, you know, it's not worth it.
And no matter how you attach it, I made another note. Call it, if you're attaching a document, call the file extension either by your name or call it, you know, last name, resume. And it's a silly example, but I, you know, had somebody that was like, generic DC for a cover letter, generic DC for a resume. And you're, you know, it's just like, nice. That's logic. But, yeah, I hope that answers that question.
How do you deal with the redundant terms of art?
Well, if it's literally a term of art, then you've got to use that. I mean, that's, you know, I would say, like, this is actually good. Look at the second page here, okay? And about halfway down, we've got overusing one word. Okay, you see that? Now, this is an example of something. I'm going to read this out loud. You're going to catch how it sounds when you read it out loud. Okay, I would like to be considered for a position in your Washington office. I would consider myself very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with you this summer. In close, please find my resume for your consideration. See, when I read it out loud, I heard consider three times, but if I read that softly, I may not catch it. I know that's kind of a variation on your sentence, on your question, but, you know, terms of art, there's nothing to do about. Those have to be. What I'm saying is, you know, don't overdo it. Sometimes it's good to repeat themes in your writing, because if you repeat certain words, you maintain a theme. You know, for example, you know, sometimes a father is just a father, and not a patriarch, or a male head of household, or a sire, you know, or something like that. I mean, just have to say father, that's okay. But you just know when, you know, when it just doesn't sound right.
I know we're supposed to emphasize what we would contribute to the organization or firm that we're writing to, but is it okay to talk about how you will value the experience, or just not do that?
I think it's okay to talk about it in the sense of how you value the experience.
Because that's one, like, I came straight from college, so I don't have, like, tons of experience, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think that in those cases, first of all, honesty is the best policy in terms of, just admit, if you don't know kind of what your practice area interests are, I think that's so, you know, it's just so much better to be upfront about it and just say, you know, I think I gave a few good examples in the back, you know, or its reputation for excellence in a variety of practice areas will allow me to develop a more meaningful appreciation for the law. You know, that kind of thing versus, and that phrasing and that thing is much different than saying, you know, profit from your firm's expertise or that kind of thing. And then the other thing is I know cover letters, you know, you should really be concerned about with selling yourself, but there's something slightly disingenuous when you get a letter, especially from 1L, that are talking about the immediate and valuable contribution they're going to make to the firm. And it's kind of like, we knew we were looking for you because, you know, our firm's
the best. Let's
look at softball. Yeah. Good point. Way to hit that one. But I would say, you know, don't be too modest, obviously, but keep that in mind. Keep and, you know, just kind of keep in mind how something like that, a phrase like that, would come across. You know, to a partner who's been with the firm for 35 years, who's like, yeah, Your immediate and valuable contribution, okay. Obviously, you're going to contribute. Believe me, you will, but it's just, you know, like I said, it's all in the way you phrase it. But I think it's absolutely fine to talk about, you know, how you could potentially benefit. It's more so the letters I get that are talking all about how, you know, you profit so much. Or one student, people always think that I'm lying when I tell these examples, but one student's part of the cover letter was all about how that we should hire him because he was going to be such a good ambassador to go back to his school and, like, help us recruit him. And I was like, no, that's really not our primary motivation. And who would be for us, you know, you're going to be a good recruiter for us next fall. So, anyway, that's just for me.
Louise, 2 minutes. I put this slide up here because this is kind of what gets that question, but I think that there's a slide I actually took out of here about how to address bad facts or unpleasant facts, whether it's in legal writing or if it's in cover letters. And I'm gonna explain to you, I'm gonna kind of combine these two ideas. In rhetoric, the idea of end focus is that the last words of sentences carry the most weight. So whenever you're writing something, anything at the end of your sentence, move all the important stuff to the right. Okay, whenever you write anything, whatever's at the end, because of when we read sentences, you know, when we read sentences, there's a rhythm, there's a cadence, and we tend to highlight certain things when we speak. It's the same thing in writing. At the end of the sentence is anything that is what the end of the sentence carries the most weight. So put the important stuff at the end of a sentence. Okay? And it's an easy test. You just elaborate, you just kind of exaggerate and intonate when you read aloud, and you're going to see which sentence sounds better. 2 days ago, while riding his bike, he collapsed. Versus, he collapsed while riding his bike 2 days ago. Obviously, the second one sounds ridiculous, so I wrote the first one. Now, I say that because this has to do with what happens if you have to address an unpleasant fact, a bad fact, or something like that. Don't put it at the end of your letter, okay, where it's going to receive attention. I mean, and I don't, this isn't necessarily a trick when I say you want to bury it. You want to minimize it. You know, you don't want to stick it, a bad fact, an unpleasant fact, in a two-sentence paragraph surrounded by white space. Because your eye's immediately drawn to that. You want to put those things in places where they're going to be addressed, but they're not going to be the focus of what you're writing about. And you just say them once and then you move on. I mean, that obviously has a lot to do in legal writing, where you have to address a bad fact in the brief. And, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, in cover letters, I think that's especially true a lot of times if you want to just give a brief explanation, maybe your grades first semester, you know, obviously you wouldn't, if you were trying to explain the discrepancy between your grades first semester and then your grades second semester, you wouldn't say, you know, I got 3 A's and a B second semester, but first semester I did really poorly and I got, you know, 4 C's in all my classes. You just reverse it. And you say, although my performance wasn't, you know, quite up to my expectations or my personal standards, I really improved dramatically, as you can see from my transcript. And, you know, even, I think those things, once addressed, if you're just very clear about it and say, you know, once I hit my stride, I really improved. And if you make that the focus of that paragraph versus the, you know, the poor performance, it really helps, just like what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's notice what Tiffany did. Here's another trick, is that she put the bad part in the dependent clause. The dependent clause depends on the independent clause for meaning. A dependent clause has no meaning by itself. So this phrase, the sentence, although I didn't do well first semester, I turned it around second semester. You're putting the although clause, the dependent clause, you're putting the bad news in there, so you're kind of dismissing it. Okay, you're not focusing, you know, I did well first semester, but I tanked second semester. I mean, that's totally different. Okay, it's the same thing, you just reversed it. So, yeah, more questions, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how do you view, like, simple cover letters that basically refer you to the resume?
I mean, I think they're fine. I honestly would, if it's a choice between a really simple cover letter that just says my resume is attached, or one that's just completely full of errors, I'd always go, you know, you're just better off doing a simple one. But I think more than that, you're missing an opportunity to really spell things out and to make, and it's an added bonus to be able to make a better presentation than just your resume alone would give you the opportunity to do. And I think that's just a theme, like, with applying anywhere for any job, you never want to miss an opportunity to make a good impression, whether it's, you know, in person or meeting someone, or if it's the difference between sending, you know, a very short, quickly written, took you 5 minutes to type out letter, or something that's much more thought out. I would always say that the delay is better. Even if it's a difference of applying for a job in August or applying for a job in September, believe me, it's much better to take the time until you can really focus on it. Yeah, you're next.
Not really on the subject of cover letters, but what are firms looking for out of a writing sample?
Sure, that's a great question. I have a couple. Like I said, my main fear of coming here today was I didn't want to come across as like, let me tell you about what all firms want, because I think that would be really difficult to do. But like I said, I've worked for three major firms, and sort of over the past 5 years or so, I've kind of gotten a hang of noticing their preferences for a lot of this stuff. And writing samples, my advice is make it a reasonable length. Please don't send something that's over 10 to 12 pages long, because that's just obnoxious. Like I said, I print everything out. So I always suggest, around 7 to 8 pages at max. My other point that I really like to tell people to do is choose your topic wisely for what you're going to submit, just because something that's written sort of maybe on a topic that could be divisive or people could have passionate feelings about, that just immediately detracts from the point of the writing sample, which is to showcase excellent writing. You know, and I honestly have. I've seen the gamut of things, and I've seen people who are submitting writing samples that, you know, advocate against the death penalty or things like that, and if they're well written, that's one thing, but I can't guarantee that the attorney who's reading it isn't thinking, oh my God, these pleas could not be further, you know, from my own, and that's not the point they're taking away. I hope that makes sense. And the other thing is be creative. Like, I'll never forget, I think it was probably 3 years ago, I got a resume, and the writing sample was, I think really simple. It must have been written for like an employment law class, but it was based on, the statement of facts was on an episode of The Office. And it was the one where it was essentially like a worker's comp claim of White Schrute after he had got the concussion while he was driving Michael to the hospital. I don't know if you saw that episode, but immediately that became like, for the entire recruiting season, this student, she was from the University of Texas, was like everyone's favorite. Like, nobody could wait to meet her because the writing sample was so funny. And it wasn't even funny in the way that it was written. It was well written. And, you know, obviously it was just taken off something that was really creative. You could tell there was some personality there. And, you know, I hope it got a good grade.
And she remembered that.
Yeah.
She has exactly what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I know exactly who it is.
Yeah.
Yes. If someone sends their application material through email, how do they usually send their transcript?
Most of the time it's a PDF, usually, yeah. And then there's a note down here about transcripts. You don't have to send an original transcript to each firm. I know some people do that, and I'm thinking, oh my God, they cost like $5 a piece. Why would you, I hope you only apply to 3 or 4 firms. But when you're photocopying, like if you get official copy issued to a student, usually it says like issued to student, like big, huge letters right down the middle of it or something like that. Just when you copy it, make sure it's legible, because a lot of times if you're scanning it or copying it, sometimes it can be appear a little hard to read. But most of the time they're attached as like a PDF or a JPEG or something in a file like that. And for most cases, an unofficial copy of your transcript is totally fine. Like print out from your internal website or that kind of thing, that's fine. Just make sure it looks professional. And then the other thing is make sure there's a name on it. Like, there's so many times where, I never like to expect the worst, but I'm like, oh, this does not have a name on it at all anywhere. It looks like someone just kind of highlighted or did a print screen and there's no name. So, and just make sure it looks professional. Maybe the other thing.
Just add to that, in OCPD we do have scanners, so you should just get one copy from the registrar's office, and if you need to scan it to a PDF, you can do that.
Perfect. Solves that problem.
What about excerpts from writing samples? Because as first years, we don't have like a lot to draw from.
Right.
So, I mean, your preference is 7 to 8 pages.
Oh no, that's, I'm sorry, that was a max too. That's I think an excerpt is fine. It always helps most of the time if we see excerpts. There's a cover, like a cover page with a short paragraph, kind of catching the reader up on what this is for and what it's about, your general point, so they know kind of what. Where the section fits in.
So when you said to make sure that your name's on everything, do you want us just to put our name in like a header on each page of the writing sample? Or?
That's what I would suggest. Yeah, I would suggest putting your name, even if it's just first initial and last name, like in the header, and then just make sure the pages are numbered. And I guess, if you're using an excerpt, don't renumber the pages, but just sort of sequential. Like I said, it just sometimes for places that do print everything out or things like that, or it just just helps. And even if you send something physically and a couple pages off the back get separated from the staple, that happens. And just so I don't forget it. When we're, I do receive a lot by regular mail. I get frequent paper cuts from opening all my letters. But I had this phone call from my friend Roger, who's in law school, and it was like frantic. And he's like, I'm at Kinko's. I don't know what color paper. Like, you know, is it ecru, eggshell? What should I order? And like, honestly, I mean, the letter's a little bit of a spaz, so that was not surprising. But it doesn't matter. Like, just use whatever paper. Like, don't use anything that's like cardstock weight so thick that it won't fold easily. And but other than that, it doesn't matter. The one thing I would caution is make sure that you're using a high-quality printer, because I see it, and I just know, like, you know, perfectionists would just cringe because if they knew their resume had gotten to me, and it was like, because it was folded like this, the text had transferred, like, all over itself. So I know I'm that type who would be like, oh, I can't believe it. So just make sure that the printer or, you know, that the ink isn't going to transfer and that it's a high-quality. I felt very nitpicky as I'm sitting here saying these things. Believe me, this is not. I mean, this is. You know, I don't want to say that it's important. Certainly, we're not going to disqualify really impressive candidates just because their resume being transferred from one sheet to the other. But like I said, a lot of times when we get resumes in hard copy, this is actually all three firms that I've worked for, we have an electronic system that's kind of capturing and keeping all of our applicants. So we take that hard copy and we scan it. So imagine if it looks all, you know, jumbled and hard to read in a hard copy, then you scan that on top of it, and you know, you're lucky if you can sort of decipher anything from it. Any other questions? Believe me, nothing. Okay, I've heard it all, so don't, if it's too random or, I mean, I guess looks like we're about to wrap up, but one thing I just really wanted to stress is that I, like I was saying earlier, don't miss out on the chance to make a positive impression with a potential employer. And one example that I like to give is during on-campus recruiting, if firms, you know, come here and you don't get selected for an interview with them, I see this over and over and over again, that people don't, you know, they just don't, if you really are interested in this firm and have specific reasons for wanting to be there, don't give up at just that. Try to stop by the room or stop by if they have an employer representative outside the door. Send it to them. Say, you know, I wasn't selected for an on-campus interview, but really wanted you to have a copy of my resume. And I say this because it happened last year in this particular situation, and it was a local law school. But we had this law student come into the room. We were hosting a hospitality suite right next door to our interview room. And he, like, came in the room, like, grabbed a bottle of juice, like, plunked down on the sofa, and was like, yeah, I didn't get an interview with you guys, but I just figured I'd come by and get some soda. In that room, there were four senior associates, myself, the recruiting manager, and Mark Riccardi, who was our hiring partner interviewing right next door, had, like, come in to just, you know, get something out of the room. Like, this guy could have completely turned his situation around if he really was truthful and that he wanted to interview with us and just didn't get the opportunity, which I don't really think is true. But in that room, you could have immediately written your ticket for a callback interview, because it just so happened that day, you know, some people look really good on paper, but just don't have that thing in person. And had this gentleman walked in and said, listen, I just wanted you to know, you know, I submitted my resume. I noticed that I wasn't selected for an interview. These are the reasons that I'm really interested in your firm versus any other. If you have a few minutes, I'd love to talk to you and tell you a little bit more about myself, a little bit more about, you know, why I think I could contribute to ORIC. Honestly, it would have been done. It would have been like, thank you, and you're coming back to the office. And that's really, I think, for at least from the firm side of things, I can't speak very much to other legal employers, but from the firm side of things, it's all about getting the opportunity to come speak with them in person and meet them in the office. So. I'm happy to stick around both of them.